The Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health will come to order. Thank you for being here this morning. I know you all probably had a pleasant drive through the sleet rain. No snow today, I don't think. Okay, we're going to, we carried over Senate Bill 355 because some people didn't have an opportunity to testify. And we have also some people who will testify by phone today. There are as many as three if we can make connections. Ramirez?
Mm-hmm.
Stacy Ramirez, are you? Oh, Stacy, would you come up, please? And Bill Cross. Go ahead, Stacy.
Mr. Chair,
I'm
just here to introduce Stacy.
Oh,
she's with
great.
The Oregon State Pharmacy Association.
Okay.
I represent both the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists, who are working together in support of this bill. And I've just prepared a little one-pager,
sure,
which is being distributed right now. But I'll let Stacy kind of go into the bill and why the pharmacists are very supportive of this proposal.
Thanks.
Let Stacy.
Thank you, Bill.
Hi. Good morning. I'm Stacy Ramirez. I am a clinical assistant professor at Oregon State University College of Pharmacy. And as clinical faculty, I actually still practice as a pharmacist in addition to teaching. And so my two practice sites, I work at a community health center safety net clinic, mainly with patients suffering from chronic pain. And then I still practice in a traditional community pharmacy. And so I kind of get both sides of this issue from the clinic setting as well as from the setting of a pharmacist trying to deal with some of the issues surrounding the challenges in controlled substance prescriptions. So I thank you very much for allowing me to be here this morning and speak in support of this bill. I am here on behalf of the OSP, Oregon State Pharmacy Association. So you've heard lots of testimony. I'm not going to go over all of the points, but I just wanted to hit on some of the things I think that are most important to pharmacists in this state. And this really is going to be a tool for all of us, pharmacists and prescribers alike, to prevent some of the unnecessary challenges that go along with controlled substances. So we've heard that, we know that these are medications that are valid for people with lots of different conditions. They absolutely have use, and protecting that use is one of the most important things that we can do as healthcare providers. Prescription drug abuse, though, is a growing problem, especially among teenagers. You heard that, you know, the population of 12 to 17 will most often turn to prescription drugs to get high versus illegal drugs because they don't see that they're dangerous. They think, oh, you know, if it came from a pharmacy, how bad can it be for me? Oregon's problem is actually larger than the rest of the country, which I think is definitely something that we need to be concerned about. There are 43 other states, as you've heard, that have prescription monitoring programs either in place or on the way. There was discussion about Washington's program and how it was stopped, and there was some testimony that made that seem like they stopped it for reasons other than what really happened, and they are purely financial reasons. The program is 5 months away from implementation. They're simply just trying to find the funding that they need in order to institute the program. So once Washington's program goes into effect, that will make Oregon sort of its own little island here with no prescription monitoring program. And so for people who are savvy with this doctor shopping, that's going to make us a big old target for, I think, people who are looking to get prescription drugs, controlled substances illegally. There was also some discussion about the fact that this program is costly. As most of you know, the Board of Pharmacy was awarded a grant, assuming that this bill passes, of $350,000 to start this program. There's additional funding of up to $450,000 that we can apply for, that the Board can apply for, to help offset some of the cost of this program, as well as the fee that will be charged to prescribers and pharmacists in order to participate. And so while it was mentioned that costs haven't gone down and some of the programs have been expensive to implement in the past, I do think that now that the software is developed and, you know, there have been 38 other states who have tested it before us. I do think that that the money that is available to us will make this program possible without accessing money from the general fund, which, again, is a concern for everyone in these economic times. The other thing that was mentioned is, you know, that this data may be, you know, this is a new database or new data that we're creating. And that simply is not the case. This data is available in pharmacies across the state, across the country right now. The way that it's accessed currently is by a doctor or someone from their office picking up the phone and calling. And lots of times, you know, there is no, as a pharmacist, I know that person personally, you know, we have to sit there and go, all right, is this really the doctor's office? Do I really want to give this information out? You know, get a phone number, can I call you back? If I have to fax over profiles. So there is some of this that's going on, but it's not nearly as secure as what would happen with this prescription monitoring program. There was also some discussion, I know, about whether or not all controlled substances should be included in this program, or should it just be, you know, Schedule 2s and 3s? Should we exclude Schedule 4s like benzodiazepines and those kinds of things? And I would absolutely advocate against that. I think that having the complete picture as a provider of healthcare is important. So if a patient comes in and they're being evaluated for a chronic pain condition, I need to know whether or not they're taking medications such as benzodiazepines. If they haven't told me that, having access to this database may provide that information. There's risk to that patient if I don't have the complete picture. There are drug interactions and there's all kinds of things that can happen. So I definitely don't think excluding any class of drugs from this, not only will it make it more cumbersome and difficult to sort out, I think that it does put patients at risk not having the full picture. And ultimately, that's really what I think we all care about, is doing the best job that we can for the patients who legitimately need these medications. And I do think that the prescription monitoring program will achieve that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bridger.
Thank you very much. In listening to the testimony that we've heard before, it occurred to me that there should be a way to know if people are taking the medication that you've prescribed. And I'm wondering if there is any process by which a person would be required to have, in other words, I don't know what it would be. If you said bring the empty bottle back, they just pour it into a different bottle. So I just wonder what gap right there can we fill to let you know whether a person actually has taken the medicine?
I think that's an excellent point. I mean, I do believe that accessing the system, we'll be able to see that information because we'll know when the prescriptions were filled. So you're never going to know completely because, as you mentioned, someone can say, you know, I've taken all my medication and dump it out before they come in. But again, it's one more tool that will allow us to look at consistency. So if they filled a prescription that was supposed to last 30 days and they filled it every 30 days for the last 6 months, then, you know, you hope that it's because they're taking the medication and not diverting it or doing something else with it. Most places who treat patients with chronic pain have systems in place that are aimed at trying to prevent types of things like diversion. So you mentioned that, someone mentioned earlier that, you know, you do random drug screens, and we do that at the clinic where I practice. We're not necessarily looking for what's there. We're looking for what's not there. So if we've given them an opioid prescription and there's no opioids in their urine, then we have a very different conversation than there would be if we did find what we were expecting to find. So I do think this is one more tool, though, that can help us just add to that picture of a patient taking the medication the way that they're supposed to.
Follow up, Mr. Jewish.
Yes.
I just read a report that most teenagers get their drugs from family members. In other words, not on the street and on a dark corner. So that would indicate to me that if a person really needed the prescription, they would run short in the 30 days. and would be calling the doctor or the pharmacist wanting them to refill it. So that would be one indication. But I think it's a real problem, and I'm not sure. Hopefully this would be of some benefit.
I agree.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Senator Cruz. Senator Cruz, would you please step to the microphone, please? Senator Cruz, there he is. He's on his way. And be sure to identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, and I've always wanted to testify before a committee I serve on. So I just kind of wanted to give a perspective, because this has been a long road. And I came into the legislature in 97. In 99, I was given the gavel in Human Services in the House. And
I was fortunate enough to serve on that committee.
Yes, you were, and the three of us have been working together ever since, and it's been a good thing, and I appreciated our friendship. An issue that came up in 99, brought up by Senator Dukes at the time, was the issue of chronic and terminal pain, and you got to understand, I came into this process as a limited government Republican, and to a degree still am. However, over time, I have helped create more government, but in very specific areas. We created a task force that interim to study the issue, and the end result of that was we created the Pain Commission, and which was an absolutely necessary thing at the time, just looking at the culture of medicine in Oregon and the things that weren't being done and the things that should have been done. This kind of came as an outgrowth of that from my perspective. And we can talk about trying to stop drug shopping and all those other things, but from my perspective, the real reason that I have supported this over the years is because it's going to help make sure that people get the care they need. And that is overriding everything else for me, is to make sure that people who have chronic pain can get the medicine they need. And with this registry, that will help. It's about eliminating errors, eliminating cross-medication. I mean, outside of everything else, the real benefit that I was driving for with this was to make sure that people could get the care they needed. It's been the thing that's driven me in healthcare on all issues, is access and appropriate care. And all the things I have done have been driving towards those goals. And I mean, clearly there's no silver bullet in any of this stuff, but colleagues, this is a absolutely critical, absolutely necessary step. And I just kind of wanted to put my perspective. I've been at this for a long, long time now. And clearly the testimony we heard Monday, I think will help us. We know that we have amendments coming on this bill, and there's a couple things that really stood out at me in some of the testimony, and we will make the appropriate amendments. But colleagues, we cannot let this session close without having implemented this program.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator DeMoss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so glad that you're mentioning the Pain Commission, because I served on it for 1 year, and when I was on it, it was very apparent that doctors were not prescribing the needed medication just because there were a few that law enforcement brought to task. In fact, we had a physician testify before us, because no other doctors were prescribing pain. He was getting most of the patients who had pain, and he was acquitted. I mean, it was dropped. So this will alleviate that, and I agree with you totally. that this will actually be in the best interest of the patient.
Yeah. Ms. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, and we needed a culture change, and, you know, from the DME on down on, you know, because there are a lot of doctors who are just afraid of sanctions inside the industry for dispensing opioids, and we have seen that change, and it's getting better, and I think the medical community is coming around, but this is a tool they need, and I have spoken to so many physicians that would like to be able to have certainty when they prescribe, and this will give them that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I too serve on the, well, I currently serve on the Pain Commission, and it's interesting. When the bill was on the floor side, when we passed the Pain Commission bill out of the House, I testified about intractable pain, and there was another speaker whose husband was a physician who questioned the wisdom of treating symptoms instead of the cause. And as one who has people close to me who are in intractable pain without knowing the cause, I think there are a lot of situations where it's very difficult to pinpoint the cause, and if you do, for sure, you still, you know, the getting rid of the pain is the important thing. You know, if it's a symptom, it is there for a reason, if you can find the reason. On the Pain Commission, it's interesting because the Pain Commission instituted some requirements to educate doctors on pain, and I've had conversations with one of my past doctors about prescribing pain medication, and he was not very excited about prescribing pain medication. He didn't really understand. He said, well, opioids are about the only thing that, you know, is out there to prescribe, and I don't like opioids. Well, that's not true. And I think that the requirement to take certain 6 hours, I believe, studying pain, the causes of pain, and the variety of medications available is extremely important for physicians. So again, this has been a 10-year process that we have been involved in, from the institution of the Pain Commission to two of us having served on the Pain Commission and one of us having created the Pain Commission. So it's something that we are interested in. Dr. Merriman, Sharon Merriman, are you in the audience? Okay, she's not here today. Okay. We do have some phone. We have three individuals who may be contacted by phone. Are we ready to do that? Let me pause for just a minute. Are there any others in the audience who would like to testify? We ran out of... Yes, would you please come up? Thank you. Any others? Because we ran out of time the last time around, and I'm not sure how many people showed up today.
Good morning, Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Wagner. I'm the Pain Management Coordinator in the Governor's Advocacy Office, and I serve as primary staff to the Oregon Pain Management Commission. I'm a nurse. I have over 15 years of my nursing career really devoted to the issue of pain management. It is certainly a pleasure to come and talk to you about the two things that are near and dear to me, that being pain management and policy. The chair of the Oregon Pain Commission, Dr. Catherine Hahn, was here on Monday, and unfortunately, due to work constraints, could not come this morning. So I'll be reading her testimony on behalf of the Pain Commission. It is the charge of the Oregon Pain Management Commission to identify barriers to appropriate pain care in Oregon and to report them to the governor and to the Legislative Assembly. The conclusions of this body's research and inquiry are meant to be held in the same regard as other governor's task forces and commissions. The Pain Commission, which includes members of the public, medical profession, and patient population, serves as a watchdog for issues that affect Oregonians in pain. It has been observed over the last 7 years of our existence that the undertreatment of pain may be linked to physicians' concerns over being duped by drug seekers. Both primary care physicians and pain specialists have asked us to help develop a system to enable them to better identify those patients that are legitimately seeking controlled substances while proactively identifying those that need intervention. Over the past 5 years, the Commission has spent countless hours debating and learning about prescription monitoring programs in other states. It has become apparent that physicians from states that have a monitoring program are more inclined to treat pain aggressively, as this program reduces the fear of being scammed. These programs have become crucial to the physician's ability to prescribe controlled substances with confidence. The Commission has been involved in a dialogue that created a unique proposed program that will securely handle information on about 9% of all prescription drugs while maintaining a near lockout of law enforcement. The Pain Commission sponsored a symposium in December of 2008 that generated dialogue between experts on prescription monitoring programs, Oregon legislators, and the public that served to form a consensus opinion to continue pressing for this much-needed tool. Finally, we believe that we have a well-written bill that will benefit patients, providers, and society by balancing adequate and available pain treatment with drug abuse prevention. We implore you to accept the Pain Commission's determination, formed from public and professional testimony and public debate, and pass this much-needed bill. Any questions?
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bridger.
Yes. In my family, we had a terminal illness, and in the last 6 months of that illness, we did not have hospice, so we needed to be very hands-on. I was amazed at even the oncologist who did not understand pain at all, and we were turned over to a pain specialist whom we didn't see, but we saw the nurse that worked with him, and she was as confused about the pain medication. So I guess that as a layperson having to make major decisions about pain and the side effects that we were going through with the pain medication, is there a lot done to address that kind of issue where professionals need to know more about pain?
Senator Berger and members of the committee, we're sure trying. So, you know, chronic pain management is not taught in medical schools. I don't know about Senator Mona Sanderson. I received very little training in nursing school about pain management. We're designed, I think, from the get-go to handle acute pain, and when that pain just doesn't get better, physicians are often less scrambling to figure out handle those situations. I think end-of-life and terminal illness certainly complicates that and in some ways is a specialty of its own. Thanks to Senator Dukes and many of our colleagues, Oregon really led the way in 2001 when we mandated 7 hours of pain management education for almost all licensed healthcare professionals in the state of Oregon. California, for instance, had 12 hours of mandatory requirement, but just for doctors. And so Oregon was unique in that we required nurses, pharmacists, psychologists, social workers, chiropractors, dentists, acupuncturists, really across the board a multidisciplinary group of people. And 7 hours isn't enough. If you ask me, we could quadruple that, and I'd probably get stoned as I left the room from the medical profession for saying that. But I'm a firm believer in you can't do what you don't know, and education certainly is key to that. I hear grumblings from the medical community about our mandatory education, but I've also had countless physicians and nurses and clinicians who have come up to me and thanked me and let me know that what they learned during that pain management education really did change how they were going to practice. And so I know firsthand that that's happening and occurring.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Merriman, would you come up, please? And Courtney Dresser, would you also come up?
Keep trees.
It's okay, we've got lots.
Okay.
Thank you for being here again today.
Thank you. I apologize for my delay in getting here.
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you. So. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay, Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I very much appreciate your letting me testify again today.
Yeah. Now identify yourself, please.
I'm Sharon Myron. I live in Portland, Oregon. I am an emergency medicine physician practicing at Portland Adventist Medical Center. I also, for the record, am a licensed attorney, which I didn't mention previously, but which does impact my review of some of this stuff. And I am in strong support of Senate Bill 355, both personally and on behalf of the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians. I mean, I won't go over everything that I mentioned a couple of days ago in my oral testimony. A couple of things. I'm here on behalf of a number of colleagues who, some of whom were here a couple of days ago, weren't able to make it back to testify again, and to some degree I'm speaking on their behalf. And then also just a couple of other points to bring up that were heard in testimony after I had finished testifying that I just wanted to briefly address. Mm-hmm. One of the more important sort of experiences that I think should be brought up were those of the Kaiser physicians that came with me on Monday, and I think one will be trying to reach for testimony by phone. But I also worked at Kaiser Sunnyside Medical Center in Clackamas, and Kaiser is an interesting place because it has a complete electronic record-keeping system. And it's been in place for, I think at least, I would be making up a number, but I believe at least decades. That tracks not only prescriptions, but all patients' medical records, emails, phone calls, progress notes, and even psychiatric information is documented. So a much more comprehensive situation, and yet, as one of my colleagues hopefully will testify by phone, but if he's unable to do so, they have very strong security systems in place to protect this very sensitive information, and these systems appear to work. The Kaiser system is an exceptional system. Without exception, my colleagues who work at Kaiser feel that having that electronic record available, including prescription medications, absolutely enhances their ability to care for patients. It improves their patient relationships because they have information at their disposal that allows them to make much more informed decisions regarding patient care. They can involve patients in discussions because they have information already that they're able to use. They can evaluate patients that come in, you know, are unconscious patients, overdose patients, and those records are at their fingertips.
My daughter-in-law works for Kaiser as a telephone nurse.
Oh.
So when someone calls in and identifies themselves, she clicks them in and
perfect.
Has everything in front of her.
Yeah.
And can talk to them about whatever their problem is.
Yeah, it's great. And then from the emergency medicine standpoint.
She works in the Bay, San Francisco area. But,
okay. That's where I'm from.
But I understand what you're talking about in terms of total access to among the Kaiser community.
It's very, very helpful. And we get, in the emergency room, we'll get those telephone nurse emails, see them immediately, see why this patient's coming in, what they're on, what their concerns are, et cetera. In Kaiser in particular, there are a number of patients with chronic pain who are on what they call opiate therapy plans. And it is very beneficial to have the system in place, particularly for these patients. having access to they're basically managed by their primary care physician, who prescribes narcotic medications on a pain contract, and you have at your disposal all of the medications that they're on. If they come in for an acute exacerbation of a condition, or out of the pain medicines, or they're not working, whatever the case may be, you can look at those records and say, well, I see that you filled your prescription a couple of days ago. What's going on here? And it really does facilitate discussion and open communication. It seems to be helpful to the patient. It's helpful to the physician, and I think just really enhances the process itself. We do see patients at Kaiser also who aren't in the system, and it really muddies the waters and makes the situation much more difficult and akin to what I described a couple of days ago with a lot of the dilemmas that we face in the ER. One of my colleagues who can't be here today really wanted me to bring up a specific case that was in the Oregonian. I believe last year it was, and I'm not sure if you've seen this article before, it's a woman who had chronic pain. Everyone in our emergency department who worked there knew her by name. She was there at least once a week for her migraine headaches, would typically get dilated when people were too busy to look through the records and see that she frequented our ER. And she was arrested in September of 2007 because after leaving an ER that was not our ER, she was driving under the influence of Dilaudid, which she had received there, and she hit a mother in front of her children and severely, permanently injured her. And it just kind of hammered home the degree to which this is not only an interaction between us and individual patients, but it really does affect society at large and other innocent people. I had a couple of random things I just sort of wanted to mention in terms of issues that were brought up, such as consent versus notification. I feel that strongly that requiring informed consent to be included in a prescription monitoring program would completely undermine the whole purpose of the program. Those who would abuse the system would refuse to consent to be part of the system, and so I think that consent doesn't make sense. It's appropriate for life, say, if you have to do invasive interventions, life-saving treatments, that kind of thing, but not for this type of program. I do think notification is important, absolutely. In that big stack of papers, I've gotten copies of some of the privacy notifications from the hospitals I've worked at, just to give ideas of what's included. They're fairly comprehensive, and personally, I think would include people being notified that they might be in this type of program, but I think it would be very simple to just add an extra paragraph explicitly stating that patients be notified that they're in this monitoring program. I think that is important. With regard to accessibility of records, which was another issue that was mentioned, someone had said that records should be completely accessible. They belong to the patient, and I just did want to differ with that slightly, because the information in the records is about the patient, but the records themselves do still belong to the institution which has compiled them. People can access their records at any hospital, but that does not mean that those records necessarily belong to the patient. I understand that concept, and hopefully in a perfect world someday, everyone will have their own personal records to take around, but at this time, it does require procedures to access your records, and I believe the PMPs do have procedures in place for access of records. Question whether or not...
Excuse me. Can a patient who's traveling get copies of their entire record to take with them? if they're going to Europe or if they're going to another state where... I'm talking about the Kaiser system.
They can obtain their records.
Okay.
I've obtained my records from the Kaiser system. You have to request in writing. You have to pay money for copies and things like that. But
well, it would be nice if you could get them on a CDC or on a CD. I'm sorry. If you can get them on a disc and take them with you, and if you are in an emergency and you're someplace else, they could take a look at your entire record. That's what I would like to have happen. I asked my doctor about that, and he just kind of said, no way, you know,
yeah.
Can I do that on a disc? But you can have a copy of everything that I have. I can have the complete copy.
You can have a stack of your paper
But I
records.
Guess what I'm talking about would be Kaiser, if a person could ask for a CD copy of their records, probably...
I think it's a great idea. I don't think they can do it yet.
Okay, but you could get, you certainly should be able to get your records in paper form.
Yep.
And pay for them and so on.
Yep.
Okay. Now, in a perfect world, we will have an expanded interconnectivity with medical records.
Yes, we would.
Yeah, nationwide, or, you know, and
yes.
have easy access to your own records.
Yes,
yeah.
I think that would be
okay.
That would be ideal.
Thank you.
And I'm not going to go over everything that I've written specifically. Just briefly, I believe that I've reviewed the website for the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws, and it describes the budgets that other states who have these systems operational have operated within, and I believe Oregon sort of falls right in the middle of those, well within the average, and that the budget that's proposed is very doable. And there's a grant available for the startup and a provider fee of up to $25 a year for prescribers and pharmacists for added on to the license fees, is my understanding, to keep this program operational. And, you know, for enhancement of public safety, I think that's a very, very reasonable fee. It's a couple of Starbucks, a year, and I think that is well worth it, personally.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Actually, this handout, thank you,
yeah.
Gave that you gave us, does talk about our rights, and yes, we have a right to inspect and copy, but there are some things that we can't get. Usually this medical and billing records may not include psychotherapy notes, and that's the one thing that we would not be privy to. And if we are denied, it says we can request that the denial be reviewed. So she did give us all the information on that.
Thank you.
And I noticed the information about the individual that you had talked about who was doctor shopping or showing up at the emergency room and had the accident and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If you would allow me, I would like to make a comment to
yes.
Dr. Marin.
Senator Berger.
Dr. Marin, you were in the audience when I made the comments about doctors not knowing enough about pain management, and I want to follow that up that I have to tell you, over the 5 years, the emergency room doctors were just so superior in being able to help us through a long and arduous journey. And even in the very last stages, when there was a very limited staff, they allowed the emergency room doctor at my request to come in because, and I wanted you to know that, because they were so effective in being able to grasp the situation. Now, whether that's because you're trained in emergencies or whether you simply have a more depth knowledge of crisis management, but it was very, very telling. And I just wanted to I've never had an opportunity to express that to any of the emergency room doctors other than those that we worked with, so I'd like to have an opportunity to say that to you.
Well, I greatly appreciate that, and that's very moving, and I do appreciate that, and I'm glad to hear it. I feel we do generally really try to
absolutely
do
great
the right
job.
Thing in those situations.
Oh, yeah.
And I just add on to to what you had said, I'm one of the people who really appreciated the ability to be required to do that training program in pain management. I think it was very beneficial. So I think, you know...
Well, I would like you to read into the record the individuals and
yes.
who signed on to this.
Yes, and any would be happy. I can give contact information if at any other time you have questions for them. But the individuals who wanted to be here today were unable, but with whom I've spoken extensively, and many of whom were here on Monday, but didn't have time to testify, are Dr. Fred Cirillo, Dr. Patricia Reno.
No, and where are they from?
Okay. Yeah. From Kaiser Medical Center in Clackamas, Oregon. Patricia Ramos from Kaiser Sunnyside Medical Center in Clackamas. Dr. Becca Wilkes at Kaiser Sunnyside Medical Center. Dr. Kevin Dean at Portland Adventist Medical Center. Dr. Richard McCollum at Portland Adventist Medical Center. Dr. Ray Stangland at Portland Adventist Medical Center. Dr. Laura Mellick at Portland Adventist Medical Center, who also may be calling in. And I think I may have, there were two others, Dr. Dan Handel at OHSU and Dr. Melissa Rockefeller at Providence Medical Center.
Well, thank you
yeah.
Much.
Do you have any specific questions for me?
I just find this so fascinating, some of the information. Every emergency physician has met them. These are drug seekers. They prick their fingers to add blood to a urine sample or toss a small pebble in and claim to have passed a nephrolith. They've mastered the guarded postures associated with chronic back pain and the facial contortions suggesting tic douloureux. They are very conversive in medical. I mean, it goes on and on on people who can abuse the system. So, some of them you're just not going to catch. They are too good.
It's true.
Too good scammers.
It's true. Yeah. I did want to just mention, if this bill is sent at any time to a work group, I would be more than happy to serve on this or be available.
Boy. Okay, we'll take you up on that.
I do.
Before you change your
and
mind,
having
we'll,
the legal and
would you write her name
background.
Down?
I do.
Okay. You're on.
That's really
right.
Help, I have to say.
Okay. Thank you very, very much for being here again.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Courtney Dresser. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. And at this point, we haven't come up to an official position on the bill, but we wanted to just chat about a few different things. And I think Senator Bates mentioned some of those issues when he testified on Monday. The makeup of the board, we would like to see more physician representation on that board. We represent, as you've seen, there's a lot of physicians who are very supportive of this. However, we at the OMA represent over 7,000 physicians. Some of them will use this type of database every single day in their practice, and some will never use it. And those folks probably wonder why they have to pay for something they're never going to use. So that's an issue for us, and I think Dr. Bates mentioned that too. And we have a few other slight amendments that we like to give to the committee. We're just finished drafting them up. There's some pretty broad strokes in there about evaluation of the program. We want to make sure that physicians are not being evaluated by a regulatory group that isn't their licensed professional group, like the Board of Pharmacy regulating what physicians are doing. So we just want to clear up some of that.
Good.
But again, once we kind of get those amendments in and see where the committee lines up, then we can hopefully come to an official position. But as you know, there's a lot of physicians, again, that will use this tool, and then there's some that just won't.
When do you plan to submit the amendments?
I can do that today.
Okay, good. That would be helpful. Then we can go from there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Montes-Anderson.
As you know, the bigger commission or board or whatever we're going to call this, it may get unwieldy. So are you are your thoughts to keep adding to the commission or removing some of these? I think there was quite a bit of thought to make sure that they covered. I see that they are. There are two physicians, because they're a representative from the Oregon Medical Board and one from the Oregon Medical Association. Mm-hmm. There's two nurses, same thing.
Mm-hmm. I think there's probably some specialty groups that should probably be involved, like the making sure there's an ER physician on board and a pain management specialist on board. So along with a general practice, you know, trying to make sure we cover all the specialty groups, because they all come with very different backgrounds, as you've heard, and opinions.
Well, it's already at 14 members, and I think you need to take that into account. And the representatives of the, just to say, the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Medical Board should be representative of all the specialty groups, I would think. But come with your amendments. We'll see.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Paige Clark and Kyle Miller, would you please come up? Paige, why are you looking surprised?
Should I?
We're going to call Dana Drews in a little while, and I wanted you here when we did call her. And Senator Cruz, did you have some questions?
Mr. Chair, kind of a response to some of the security issues that were brought up Monday, and Mr. Miller could kind of do that for us, I believe. So,
Chair Marset, members of the committee, for the record, I am Kyle Miller. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the Department of Human Services. I testified on Monday. On Monday and today, I've been listening to testimony. Again, I continually hear that we have information already available out there. We're just looking at maybe moving it to another application. There's still issues, even today, on identity management and access control. People are attempting to get access to the information and do things. This bill and the proposal will actually improve the access control and identity management. In addition to what I was listening to, I have concerns just on the practice of what I would call incident management. Information will be released. It's probably being released now. It's just not being tracked. As part of the, with the pharmacy board and the group that's going to be meeting together, a true incident management program could be put in here. So if patient information is released, they can be notified. The corrective actions can be taken care of to try and continue to reduce those risks. At the way I'm taking, as I listen to people talking right now, as they bore testimony, is that I don't believe that we have that right now. Patients probably don't know of information that's being released at this time. So I have some grave concerns about just the current practices they're having now. But I believe that this bill and this system will help fix those issues. And that's all. I have any questions?
And thank you, Ms. Chair. I just wanted to get that on the record. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paige?
Chair Morissette and committee, I assume that probably in following Kyle, you'd like to hear about those programs that are out there in the nation. Is that what you would like to hear?
Put your name on the record, please.
I'm Paige Clark, the pharmacist consultant for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, and I also have Karen McLean with me, who's our budget individual from the Board of Pharmacy,
okay.
If you have questions on that as well. Kyle and I have had the opportunity to have several conversations about some of the vendors that provide such programming in the nation out there, and there are sort of three main vendors that we have spoken with, and they do address a number of these issues in these programs, such as rolling audits of the system, for example, seems to be fairly standard. And these audits then would have a trigger point to show if perhaps a number of reports were being requested from a certain entity, for example. And Kyle and I actually spoke about that this morning. And once we get to the point where we're able to proceed with the budget situation and the RFP process, then perhaps Kyle would be very useful in those conversations in saying, here are the components we want to check off and be sure that they're all there. there in these programs. The verification and authentication processes that we've learned about that these programs provide, the various passcoding, passwording systems, how all of those work to provide the surrounding security around the system such as this. So hopefully that's useful to you to know that we are having those conversations, and Kyle has sort of, you know, got his checklist of things that the state of Oregon would like to see potentially present in these programs, and these vendors assure me that of course these programs have such security measures surrounding them as well. So hopefully that's useful to you.
Mr. Chair, and I think it's vitally important that Mr. Miller's involved, that DHS signs off on the security in this program. So it's a good collaboration here.
Okay. Thank you. Do we want to hear about the budget? What give us? Do you have information that you can share at this point, a preliminary sketch of the budget?
Chair Morissette, my name is Karen McLean for the record. I'm the Administrative Director at the Board of Pharmacy, and I also administer the Harold Rogers grant that our agency has had for the last 4 or 5 years. So I've been intimately aware of this budget for a lot of years now, and the budget that I preliminarily prepared last fall and provided to the committee at your request hasn't changed. That budget includes, for 09-11, one and a half full-time position, or part-time and full-time positions, a full-time project manager in addition to a part-time pharmacist. It includes resources for the commission or the advisory board, as it's stated in the bill, for their travel expenses to come to meetings in Portland. As that grows, that will also adjust or modify that number, perhaps. It includes information, our resources for national training resources for people to go to conferences and such. This is a very collaborative process, as we've all learned over the years, and lots and lots of being able to share with other states how other states are doing things, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. So those national meetings are very important. At this point, we have, as Paige indicated, spoken with three different vendors about the IT component. They have incorporated many of those desired requirements that the bill requires and that many people have voiced as concerns, security, et cetera, being able to authenticate who's getting into the system and use the system properly. The last quote that I did receive from one of the organizations included startup costs for the first year of $185,485 for the IT component. That's not the actual equipment itself. It's the software component, working with a vendor to get that up and running. And then subsequently, for each year thereafter, based on the number of pharmacies that we have in Oregon, $128,501. And I expect that those numbers are going to go up and down depending on what is included in the RFP and the services that we request. But at this point, this is the estimate that we have to work with. I did include, we have extended the Harold Rogers grant through July of this year, and as we continue along this process, we're able to ask for ongoing extensions for the remainder $300,000 for the implementation grant. We've used a portion of the planning funds. It was $50,000. Part of that was spent to help put on the symposium that was in December that you've heard about. And we have about $20,000 left right now, between $18,000 and $20,000 left of the planning funds and resources. So we would estimate that there's a need for revenue in the new biennium of 09-11 of about $340,000 to satisfy between the federal funds and the state funds what we would need. And I understand that it is written into the bill for a fee of $25 for practitioners. So approximately, it's about $606,000 for 2011-13 biennium. After the startup is in, all things considered with salaries and wages, et cetera, as they modify, the budget hasn't changed since I last provided it to the committee. So if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Yes, Senator Mark Sanders.
Is this fee-driven? Or you're asking for general fund? I'm afraid I don't remember.
No.
Fee-driven.
You're working very, very closely with the fiscal office.
Yes, I am.
Right.
Chair.
Okay. Do you plan to put in a $100,000 backup as you did, were willing to do last time? you may or may not have $100,000?
Well, Chair Morissette, that's a very good question. We have not talked about that
this time,
and I don't know that the Board of Pharmacy would be opposed to that, but
okay.
I do know that under current limitation that would not be available.
Okay.
But we have it in our ending balance.
Okay. Yes. The part of the problem last time, and Senator Cruz and I met with the fiscal office probably four or five times about the fiscal impact, because that's extremely important. And the recommendation was, even though it was estimated that there would be no fiscal impact on the state of Oregon, they suggested that, just as a precaution, that there be some backup money from the Board of Pharmacy. And they even said, and they have the money. Now, that was 2 years ago. So, and I don't know if that would be suggested this time, but it was something that we did do last time. Yes.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator,
in relationship to that, the fiscal impact study does say that the governor's budget for the board includes fee increases that, if approved, would generate 9 months ending balance. So, and that you may not need the full $25 fee. So I think that's a choice, whether you keep the fee and use that ending fund balance to subsidize it or not. But it looks to me like it's built into the governor's budget to allow you to increase your fees. It's not. It's been cut. It just says that here. That's just wondering what.
Two parts here. Chair Morissette, Senator Toeffler, let me be very clear. We've looked, the development of the agency's budget does not include the prescription drug monitoring program
right.
at all. The dollars associated with the Board of Pharmacy are for the current and ongoing operational funds of the Board of Pharmacy. Mm-hmm. The Bill 355, Senate Bill 355 that we're hearing today, includes up to $25 fee for practitioners to support this prescription monitoring program now and in the future. So the fee increase that the Board of Pharmacy is asking for is not specifically directed to help run and operate a prescription drug monitoring program. That is a whole, it is essentially a brand new program to the Board of Pharmacy and would require additional funding. And for what this program is, it's not, how do I say this right? It's not directly connected to what the Board of Pharmacy is doing today. And right now, only pharmacies and pharmacists and pharmacy practitioners pay those fees associated with the Board of Pharmacy. This program is for medical professionals, et cetera, in order to facilitate everybody's process. And so what this fee included in Senate Bill 355 does is allow everybody to participate in that in a small way.
Follow-up question,
yes.
So this reference really doesn't apply to anything.
Correct. I haven't seen that yet. Did it just come out this morning?
It just came out this morning.
So I looked last night before I left. It hadn't come out yet.
So as far as the fiscal impact, then we would want to delete that as consideration.
I can talk to the fiscal analyst.
Well, that's why I think it's really important that you talk to fiscal.
Yeah,
and stay in touch.
It just came out. So
yeah.
I'll follow up with her.
We spent a lot of time talking to fiscal last time. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's the one component that we left up in the air last time, which is why fiscal had issues with it, is because we didn't have a fee in the bill.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So this fee, as I understand it, will generate the sufficient revenue to run the program. So we are in a different dynamic this time around.
Absolutely.
And also, this may, there's going to be issues. We're going to have to discuss. Senator Bates was looking at the Patient Safety Commission as well, and a structure there, and so there's some issues we have to settle amongst us kids as to how we structure that sort of thing. So, but it is a different dynamic with the fee in the bill this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Morissette, I had one thing to add for the record. Paige Clark, the pharmacist consultant for the Board of Pharmacy. I know that a number of you received an article yesterday, I believe it was, from your state news, the Council of State Governments, and it was a very interesting article that actually refers to prescription drug monitoring programs called Accidental Overdoses from Legal Drugs. And interestingly enough, in the second column there, it talks about controlling misuse and abuse, and it refers to the fact that the Department of Justice Harold Rogers Prescription Monitoring Program supports program development. A number of states have adopted these, et cetera, and it refers to the fact that it costs, they estimate $350,000 of startup, which is the amount of our grant. That's what that is documented in here, the Department of Justice estimates. And it goes on to say that the states operate the programs with annual budgets ranging from $100,000 to $1 million, and that's documented in that article for you as well, which is sort of a nice demonstration that really these programs can run from a very modest amount of $100,000 clear up to $1 million, and you'll note that ours is right in the middle of that. And so we do feel comfortable looking at the number of states that have programs such as this out there that are using these excellent vendors that address the security issues, et cetera, and are well within the budget. And as you said, Senator Morissette, the difference this time is that not only do we have the federal funds to get the program up and going, get everything set up, et cetera, for the pharmacies to report, but we also, you all have put in language that will accommodate permanent funding, and that is a difference, Senator Telfer, that you referred to. So thank you.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Dana, would you stay there, though, please?
Oh, yes.
Page. We're going to, how do we reach? Dana. We're going to reach Dana. Would you like to introduce her when?
Yeah. This is Dana.
Hi, Dana. This is Senator Bill Morissette.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, we're just fine, Dana. The sun must be shining back there, right? It's raining here.
It was pouring this morning.
Oh, well.
We had a brief lull, so it's not raining right this minute, but we're expecting some heavy rain and extreme winds later.
Oh yeah, yeah, tornadoes and hurricanes. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
We don't have them out here. We have earthquakes and.
I should come out there.
Yeah. Well, we're in committee, and Paige is going to introduce you.
Okay.
Hello, Dana. Actually, I will leave that perhaps to you to introduce, but I will say that you do run the Ohio program, the prescription monitoring program in the state of Ohio, and probably are recognized as one of the leading experts in the nation on the issue of prescription monitoring programs. It's also notable that you happen to not only be a pharmacist, but a lawyer as well, and therefore look at many of these issues perhaps with a very unique and very well-educated stance, as you can speak to issues of HIPAA and issues of how programs are constructed, et cetera. And I know that Oregon extends its thanks to you for being very much a support and a place that we could turn to get background and information. You've been very, very generous with that. So thank you for joining our committee this morning.
Sure. I'm happy to be here.
So you can go ahead and introduce yourself again, but I would just like to add that you did spend considerable time with us during this last session and attended some of the hearings and did testify before the Senate committee and the House committee. And I don't know if you're going to join us this time, but we appreciate you being on the phone. Now, your background, I think, did you start with the state of Kentucky? Is that true?
Yes, I worked with the state of Kentucky.
Yeah.
I worked in their drug control program for over 25 years, and when Kentucky passed their PMP legislation, it fell to my agency to develop and implement that program, and I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time.
Okay.
So we developed that program from the ground up. In those days, there were not a lot of vendors to help with, so we had to do a number of things in-house that we don't have to do today.
Dana,
we developed
Dana.
A good program. I retired from state government and then came to Ohio, and they had just passed their prescription monitoring legislation, and they asked me to develop their program as well. So that's what I've been doing, and I've been here since October of 2005.
Okay. Now, Kentucky was the first state to adopt the program, is that?
No, actually, Kentucky was about number 18.
Oh, I see.
Best known. We got a lot of good press. We did some things different there and got a lot of recognition, but Kentucky was not the first state.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and identify yourself on the phone in your own voice for the record, please.
Okay, my name is Dana Droz. First name is spelled D-A-N-N-A. Last name is spelled D-R-O-Z. I'm a pharmacist attorney. My title with the Ohio State Board of Pharmacy is Prescription Monitoring Program Administrator. I'm responsible for developing and administering the program on a day-to-day basis. I supervise a staff of two IT folks and an administrative assistant. I have a degree in pharmacy from the University of Kentucky and a degree in law from the University of Louisville. A lot of background in prescription drug abuse and diversion investigation, state regulation issues with related to prescription drugs.
Thank you. Go ahead and, well, first of all, are there questions from the panel of Dana to start with?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monsanto, sir.
Have you seen our legislation, or if you haven't, could you address maybe some problems that we should look for that we need to address?
I looked at your legislation last year, made a number of suggestions. The last version that I saw had incorporated most of those, but if it's changed since then, I'd be happy at any point to take another look at it and see if I see any holes that need to be filled or anything, any suggestions that I could make.
The main change is that this is going to be a fee-driven program. Is that what other states do? Of course, other states seem to have other revenue sources.
A fee-driven program, a fee to whom for what?
To providers, a $25 a year fee.
Oh, okay, I see. Yes, there are several states that fund their programs that way. Some of them use direct provider fees. Some of them it's tied to a controlled substance license or some other type of license. But there are a number of states that use that mechanism.
Thank you.
Okay. other questions?
Well, yes. We did have one concern that some physicians don't use it, so really may not want to participate, be required to pay a fee. When you in the states, have you seen that? I mean, I envision that maybe some physicians may think they may not want to use it, but it just seems like such a great tool. Do most physicians participate, or who do you see mainly using the program?
In the states that use a fee like that, it's assessed on all of the providers without regard to whether or not they use the program. If you tried to base the fee just on who uses the program, it would be much more expensive for those users, and that would be a disincentive to providers to use the program. And what we're dealing with are societal issues, so I don't think it's quite fair to put the fees just on the people who choose to use it, because those are the individuals that are really trying to do a good job and treat their patients in the best manner possible.
And then one other question regarding the makeup of the board. Do you have boards that oversee? We're going to develop a commission, and
several states have a similar type arrangement where they have a board or a commission or some type of advisory council. We don't have that here in Ohio. We use the pharmacy board to oversee our activities and rules and things like that. But a number of states use that process.
Thank you.
Thank you. There was one other question that came up the other day concerning law enforcement access to the program.
Huh?
And what criteria we would use for law enforcement to access the program.
From what I've read, your current law or your current proposal is requiring a court order. There are several states that operate in that manner, others don't. Here in Ohio, we use a two-step request process where two separate law enforcement officers have to sign off on any request. They also have to have an investigation already going on a specific individual. They cannot use the program for fishing expeditions. But if you're requiring a court order, that's a pretty high standard, and it's not unreasonable to go that route.
And we could use probable cause, insert that into the language. Is that?
You could. Generally, that's inferred.
You're right.
Of a court order.
That's.
In order to get a court order, I thought that the officer had to provide probable cause, but it certainly wouldn't hurt to enumerate that in your bill.
Well, the question came up last time about that, and I said I just don't understand why it isn't probable cause, because if we're dealing with a court order, there has to be probable cause.
Right.
Yeah. So, but we could insert the language just to be sure.
Yes.
Okay. Others wishing to ask questions?
Well, Ms. Chair, just a light moment, because she graduated from Kentucky and then got a law degree from Louisville. Is there a mixed loyalty there?
Only when they play each other.
Okay.
Paige, did you have anything to add?
Let's see. Dana, one last question that I know was asked was regarding the HIPAA status of these programs. As a lawyer and a pharmacist, can you make comment as a program director?
On the HIPAA status, is that what you said?
It is, yes.
Okay. HIPAA is very important in looking at these programs, but the HIPAA language currently contains four exceptions for disclosures. So disclosures are allowed in four specific instances, one of which is if the disclosure is required by law, which if your bill passes, that would qualify. It also, there's an exception for a law enforcement investigation, for public health purposes, and then, of course, for treatment. So the way the programs are set up, they would fall into at least three and often four of the exceptions that are already set forth in HIPAA. So there's no problem with setting up the program so that treating prescribers and pharmacists can get information about their own patients, not on just anybody, but only on their own patients. That is, of course, allowed by HIPAA without patient-specific patient consent, also if it's required by law. Now, there was some discussion when HIPAA first was passed about waivers to HHS, and it was later determined that because these exceptions are already written into HIPAA, that there are no waivers from HHS required in order to set up a prescription monitoring program.
Thank you for that clarification. We appreciate your expertise.
Other questions, other comments? Well, thank you very much, Dan. We appreciate your participation this morning, and we will send you the current information copies of the bill and keep in touch with you.
Fabulous. I'll be happy to help in any way possible.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay.
Fred Cirillo.
Okay. Fred Cirillo.
He's an emergency room physician from Kaiser Permanente.
And he wanted to call.
She's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was. She was here several times last session. So we used her a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Am I excused?
Oh, thank you.
Hi, this is Fred
Cirillo. Fred, this, Dr. Cirillo, this is Senator Bill Morissette. We're in committee this morning. Did you wish to add some information? Did you wish to testify?
Yes, I would like to.
Okay. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, then, please.
Sure. My name is Fred Cirillo, and I'm a board-certified emergency medicine physician. I work for Kaiser Permanente. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'd like to say a few words in strong support for Senate Bill 355. First, I want to thank you for making time to hear my testimony as an extension from the hearing on Monday. My apologies for not being there in person today. I'm just finishing up an overnight shift at our hospital in Clackamas right now. Although I speak as an individual and not as a representative from Kaiser Permanente, I would like to share some of my experiences at Kaiser where we already have quite a bit of experience with electronic medical and pharmacy records. That 80% of the patients that I see in the emergency department are insured through Kaiser, and for these patients, I have immediate computer-based access to absolutely every note from their visits, phone contacts, letters, even emails that the patients might send between themselves and their doctors. I can also see every electronic prescription ordered and every medication that was sold to the patient through one of Kaiser pharmacies. You can hear me clearly?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay, I feel like I'm speaking into thin air.
No, you're speaking to a room full of people.
Okay, good. Well, stop me if I'm breaking up or anything. So as a clinician, I can say that this is really ideal from our perspective, having these records. They're legible, they're accurate, they're complete, they're up to date, they're instantly accessible, and I can search through them via filters on the computer. So if a patient presents with abdominal pain, I could immediately find out what their previous workup was and what medications they've been prescribed. And if the patient presents unconscious, I can immediately determine what medications they are on. The patients are generally extremely happy with this system, and I've never heard of complaints. In fact, I strongly believe that the accessibility that the clinicians have to information only enhances the doctor-patient relationship. I have a much better understanding of our patient's pathology and underlying conditions than I otherwise would have, and it saves the patient time in not having to reinvent the wheel every time they're seen by a new clinician. As for security goes, we have multiple safeguards in place to prevent inappropriate access. First, every Kaiser employee who has computer access has signed an oath that they will only use the computer-based information for appropriate patient care, and there are penalties for misuse. Second, non-clinicians, such as clerks and technicians, do not have access to medical and pharmacy information, which is not required for their job. And third, there's a computer record of every time anyone accesses a medical record. So although Kaiser doesn't have a proactive way to monitor this, we're able to retroactively search if there's any question. And patients have a right to review who's accessed their medical information, which is similar to one of the provisions of Senate Bill 355. So although I don't directly deal in this aspect of Kaiser's system, I've never heard of any concerns from the patient's perspective regarding security. Now, specifically concerning how we deal with narcotic medications, many of the Kaiser patients with chronic pain are already on what we call an opiate therapy plan, which is essentially a contract between a patient and their primary provider, who is the sole person prescribing pain medications. And in the emergency department, fairly often we see these patients come asking for additional pain medications for a variety of reasons. They've run out of their medications early, their pain is not controlled with the medications they've been prescribed, they might have a new injury or complaint, or their medications have been lost or stolen. They're usually presenting after hours when their primary provider is not available. And it's my job to evaluate if this is a legitimate change in the patient's condition to justify going out of their contract. And if yes, then I'll give them a limited quantity of medication to last until they can contact their primary provider. But if this isn't really a legitimate concern, then I do have to confront the patient in an honest and compassionate manner and explain that I can't justify going out of their contract, and they'll have to talk with their primary provider if they want additional medication. And I found that if done with the right approach, patients are generally very understanding, and I've never had any problems in this type of situation. Now, while 80% of my patients are insured through Kaiser, the other 20% are from outside of our system. And practically every shift, I'll see some outside patients with complaints of pain who are specifically asking for narcotic medication. And often I have a strong suspicion that these patients are drug-seeking. Very occasionally, there's some prior documentation about their previous visits and possible drug-seeking behavior. And where there is prior documentation, it's my job, again, to evaluate if this patient is presenting with a legitimate complaint and review their prescription history and determine whether their current condition warrants treatment with further narcotics. And about once a month, I'll need to tell a patient that they have been previously noted to be drug-seeking, that their presentation does not seem appropriate to treat with further narcotics, and that I'm not going to prescribe the medications, and it's in their best interest. And the response to this is generally mixed. Sometimes patients are very understanding, and sometimes they can be angry with me and confrontational. And occasionally I've had people escorted from the hospital by security. I don't enjoy these situations, but it's the right thing to do. I think it's appropriate patient care and appropriate for protection of the public. So for non-TAS patients where I have suspicion but I don't have any prior documentation of drug seeking, I don't have any way currently in real time to know what medications they've received or what other providers they've seen. This is extremely frustrating. In this situation, my practice currently is to take patients at their word. I would never want to leave a patient who sought my help in pain. And many of these patients do have legitimate complaints for which narcotic medication is appropriate. However, I'm certain that some percentage of the Percocet and Vicodin that I prescribe to these patients is going to either feed their addiction or is being sold on the street. Having a prescription monitoring program would help tremendously to sort out patients with legitimate reasons to get narcotic medications from those inappropriately seeking drugs. On my shift this past Saturday evening, I saw a woman in her mid-30s with complaint of low back pain going on for years, worse from her job as a waitress, and that the pain was keeping her awake lately. She said that she's already using the maximum dose of ibuprofen and Tylenol and would like some Percocet because this works better for her pain than Vicodin. And she told me that she'd moved here from Nevada 3 months ago. She was previously taking Percocet prescribed by a physician in Nevada, but said she had run out quite a while ago and hadn't taken any narcotic medication for months. And her story sounded real, but at the same time, as you can tell, there's a number of red flags for drug-seeking behavior in there. And if there was a prescription monitoring program in place, I would definitely have used it to see if she had recently bought opiate medications in Oregon. As it was, I gave her the benefit of the doubt and gave her a prescription for 20 Percocet tablets and can only hope that they're being used for appropriate purposes. So, in summary, a prescription monitoring program that's implemented by SB 355 would be a very powerful tool for me and other emergency medicine doctors to use. In my experience at Kaiser, where I'm not only a doctor but a patient as well, is that the theoretical privacy concerns have not borne out in reality. So I'd be happy to answer any questions for you, and thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Doctor, are you aware of physicians, emergency room physicians, who have simply denied medication to patients that they have suspected but not had any indication that they're seeking?
There's a whole range of presentations, and you know, we can tell when someone is obviously scamming us and doing a poor job of it. There are such situations where, yes, I will deny without prior documentation.
We did have testimony last session from a patient from the area that I'm from that was in great intractable pain and went to the emergency room and said that the doctor denied the prescription that he requested, and he was very frustrated. Ironically, the testimony later said, well, gee, if we'd had this system, then that could have been checked out and you would have received your... But he was actually testifying against the bill and was denied in the emergency room, which would not have happened if the system had been in place. So,
Well, you know, on the other side of that, if the bill was in place and there was a patient who presented who really touched off all the buttons saying, this is a drug seeker, I probably would go to the computer and look them up and at least have that bit of information to discuss with them rather than to go blind as is what our situation is right now.
Okay.
So I think it can work both ways, in that there might be some situations where people, like this patient you're talking about last, at the other session, might actually get the narcotic medication instead of being denied.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, comments? Thank you very much, Dr. Rui. Really appreciate your participation today.
Sure, thanks for your time.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, we have one more phone.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's Laura Millick, who is an emergency room physician from Portland. Thank you.
This is the last one.
Okay, go ahead. Okay. We tried. Others wishing to testify this morning. There is some very important testimony that I was going to submit into the record today, but because it is so moving and so touching that I will see if I can get in touch of the mother and father of the boy who, the young man who died because he was a drug seeker. It's very compelling testimony, and I will ask them to come back at the next hearing that we have, and otherwise I would make it available in writing, but it is a very touching, moving story that she has to tell. She said that if her son had died from street drugs, whoever the provider was would go to jail, but because he died from doctor shopping, then there was no culpability, no liability. And it's a very interesting story. So I'll ask that the lady and her husband were both here last time, but they didn't have a chance to testify.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a couple of questions that I would like to have answered next time around, and it just has to do with the makeup of the commission. I need to understand on page 5M, it says a health professional licensing board that regulates addiction counselors. It probably means a health professional licensing board member. And then there's the Department of Human Services. I'd just like to have someone just address why they chose the members that they did.
Okay.
Next time around.
Okay. The next time around. We have a number of amendments, and we will probably wait for a week or two. We have a full schedule of other bills to hear, and we will have at least one more hearing and possible work session, and perhaps two hearings, public hearings, before we have the work session. And then the bill, if it passes out of committee, will go to the floor of the Senate. If it passes, it will go to the committee in the House, I believe. And it's a circuitous, torturous route. And we made this trip last time, and the bill did pass out of the House committee, but was then kind of stalled for a while, and the session ended. I think that we have hopes that we can move the bill expeditiously. So with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 355, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 154. Would you like to give us a summary of Senate Bill 154?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 154 was originally heard on February 2nd. This measure repeals the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program, which was established in the Department of Human Services. And at that time, we were waiting for a fiscal impact statement. We have subsequently received that statement from Legislative Fiscal Office.
Mm-hmm.
And it says?
And pardon me. Given the low enrollment there, if you'll recall, there was three individuals currently that were enrolled in that program. In speaking with the HS this morning, there is now actively two members enrolled in that program. As far as the fiscal impact statement, LFO has found that as a result of the repeal of this assistance program, the biennial other funds revenue would have a reduction of $300. And in addition, at the end of November 2008, the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Fund has another funds revenue balance, would have one of $28,185.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 154 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Montes Anderson moves Senate Bill 154 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? Seeing no discussion, would the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Montes Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Topper.
Aye.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Excused.
Aye.
The bill passes the Senate floor, and Senator Cruz will carry this bill.
That's what happens when you don't show
up. Yeah. That's what happens when you don't show up.
Very good.
SJR1.
Well, let's see, SJR1, I don't see...
What's sitting in
the... Katie King.
Lorraine is here. King.
She was in the audience. She might have stepped down.
Lorraine is here. Lorraine.
From
DHS.
Okay, SJR1. We'll open a public hearing.
Jim Anderson's bill.
Pardon me? Jim. Well, I know. Jim, did you want to... Jim, would you come up? And who is here from...
Here you go.
Maureen.
It's right here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJR1 directs Department of Human Services to review the immunization requirements.
Okay. Jim, we had a discussion on this bill, and you go ahead and give us your take on SJR 1.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Jim Anderson here today representing Wyeth Pharmaceutical. We did have a discussion Monday on this bill, and I would like to enter into the record some testimony explaining our position presently on the bill. But first, I would like to thank Senator Montes Anderson and her interim committee for introducing the bill as an interim committee bill. It helped expedite the process tremendously, and also thank Senator Margaret Carter for finding out about this at one of the hearings that we had here in Salem, that she took up the gauntlet and started forward with this and kept pressing us forward until we got a resolution. She has a very personal stake in this legislation. But I would like to first of all explain to you that all of health care expenditures as we know them, next to clean water, vaccines add more value to health care than anything else that we have in the health care system. Mm-hmm. As you will note in one of the two pieces that was handed out to you, child care providers, and that's the NACCP letter, they want children to be healthy and not spread diseases to other children. They do not perceive school entry requirements to be burdensome. Additionally, having entry requirements help to protect our broader community. This is known as the herd effect. And you could probably relate to it. Polio vaccine was one. Smallpox vaccinations is another. Diseases that we do occasionally still hear about, but for the most part, they're gone out of society. In early 2008, Wyeth spoke with the Department of Human Services, specifically individuals in the immunization program attached to the Public Health Division, about adding a child entry requirement for pneumococcal disease and suggesting that they develop an objective criteria to determine which vaccines should have this requirement. Unfortunately, these suggestions were dismissed. However, we are pleased that the program has changed its mind and recently adopted new school criteria, which they may pass out to you, but it is in this form, and that was recently done. And we commend them for taking this very important step forward. The purpose of Senate Joint Resolution 1 is to encourage the immunization program within the Public Health Division to more expeditiously review vaccines for school entry requirements. If the program will commit to report to the legislature on a regular and timely basis. There is no longer a need for Senate Joint Resolution 1. We hope the department will give you this commitment today, and SJR 1 will be withdrawn. The report that I mentioned could be as much as a review of their findings and planned actions in the future before the committee took up today. I had the pleasure of speaking with Catherine Bradley, who you will hear from later, and mentioned to her about this fact of getting the information that these people do and work on during the interim, getting it to a standing committee. Most often DHS and all the divisions of that department are heard before Ways and Means. Some of you sit on Ways and Means, some of you don't. There is a breakdown of communication. They need to make health committees in both houses aware of what they do. And I think that this would help you, this would help me, this would help them. The second handout that you have is simply a backup. This just recently, January 28th, as a matter of fact, came out in the Statesman Journal, and it points right to the message the Senate Joint Resolution is trying to convey. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I know you have a long list of people who would like to testify today, so I will turn it back to you and ask for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Catherine Bradley? Now, we have a long list of people who were here for the last bill, some of whom signed up for this bill, too, but I... Okay.
Thank you, Chair Morissette. I was wondering if I might invite Lorraine Duncan.
Yes, of course. I was... Okay.
And Dr. Paul Cieslak, who is our medical
director.
Yes,
thank you
director.
Very much. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. My name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, and the immunization program is within our office. We are handing out some packets that I'm just briefly going to go through. What we're trying to do is provide a little bit of background and information to the committee about our school law process. We do appreciate the concerns that were raised by our colleagues about the importance of transparency between in decision-making that goes on in public-private processes, and we do hope that you'll find that with the information that we're providing today that there is a system and a process we've had in place, an ability for public and private comment and engagement, and just the bottom line is clear transparency in terms of decision making. In your packets, and just to sort of briefly go through them, the first thing I just wanted to point out to you is we have a schedule of the current vaccines. For those of you who are familiar with them as parents, you are very familiar with the challenges of trying to meet the needs of this. This actually is a four-page document and has a tremendous amount of information for providers about guidelines and footnotes about how to manage a pretty complex schedule. The top one is for our children 0 to 6. The bottom one is what's being used for adolescents and adults nowadays. And we can speak to that further later if there's more information requested. The first thing that I wanted to really draw your attention to is the handout that has the blue and the green on the front of it. What we've tried to do is provide essentially a flow chart to give you the context of how really vaccines are approved at the national level and then moved into the state level and then eventually into school law. So what you see at the top in the blue with the national picture is really what happens. ACIP, which is the Committee on Immunization Practice at the national level that makes recommendations about new vaccines and moves them into practice, is actually the first step in terms of the process. We're actually very lucky here in Oregon because Dr. Cieslak on my left is actually a member of that committee, so Oregon has a voice in that as well as we have all the latest information on vaccine issues at the state level. When they make a recommendation, what then happens now is what's called a harmonized schedule, and this was referenced in SJR 1, but it really is an attempt from the pediatric community, the family practice, and the ACIP to all get on the same page and provide the same set of recommendations to their providers, because these really are clinical guidelines. They are not guidelines for states, but they're clinical guidelines for providers. So they do a nice job, I think, nationally now for getting on the same page together. These recommendations are then sent out, and as you move into the green, this is really what happens at the state level. So Oregon gets that information at the state level, and then we begin to look at how do we sort of get that information out to our different providers. As you'll see on the right-hand side, we get federal funding for our VFC, which is our Vaccine for Children program. We take a look at funding. We look at standing orders. We look at education. There's a tremendous amount of work that goes out in the first year or two, sometimes even longer in the community, about educating providers, educating families, and helping them to understand what the new vaccine's about and allowing them to have a chance to have that uptake into the community. It is not automatically assumed to be a school addition because we really need to understand the impact in the community and have a better understanding about what the issues are related to that. At some point in time, what you'll see on the left-hand side is IPAT requests review of vaccine. That is our state immunization policy advisory committee that works closely with our program, that meets quarterly, has multiple providers, third-party insurers, many participants in that, and they do the initial review as the vaccine has been in place for a while, and at some point in time, they usually make a recommendation that the school law committee might consider it, and then it would move forward to the school law committee. So we've got a couple of steps that have taken place in the first couple of years that most vaccines are out in the community. As you'll see from the flow chart, if there's actually a recommendation from the advisory committee then to consider the vaccine, then it's sent forward to the school law committee. Our school law committee has been in place since the 1980s. It's a long-established process. We have an annual meeting at a minimum. There are partners, again, with private and public partners and our Department of Education, and they review a list of criteria in terms of what are the needs for moving it forward. Those criteria are now published, and they are in the white piece that's attached here. And they speak to issues such as cost effectiveness, the appropriateness for our population, vaccine uptake in the community, what the true burden is to parents, and things like adequate supply of vaccine. So there are a number of different components. I will say our history in this has always been strong. A couple of years ago nationally, when these criteria were developed by one of the National Immunization Program Manager Association, Oregon was actually the consultant to that process because of our history and background in this. What we had not done was, I think, really publicize these, and these are now on our website and will be the standard process that we will be using as we move forward with this. And that information and the minutes from that also can be automatically put on our website so that we think that we can make sure that this is a public process that is pretty well understood. Just briefly, because I want to allow you time for questions, as you'll see on the second page of the document in yellow, recommendations come from the school law committee to the program. It is DHS's immunization program that ultimately makes the recommendation, so it is the state that has that final decision. And then down in the purple, what you will see are all the multiple steps that then have to follow with the state process of if we move it into the school process, OARs have to be drafted. There's a public relations campaign, a number of different issues around computer systems, handbooks, and, of course, all the attendant work that would go into something like that precedes it. The one other thing I wanted to point out, and we won't go into too much detail, but the second handout that you have in color really is about what happens at the school level every single year around the school exclusion process. And just to appreciate the complexity and the work that goes on in this, the partnership between the schools and the county health department that starts in September when a child's enrolled and the immunization information is provided to the school, in October and November when there's record review that goes on at the school, a notice is sent to parents if they do not have all their immunizations. In December, there are updates in the school. In January, a completed list actually goes to the county health department, and that's down in purple at the bottom of your first page. Moving to the top of the second page, the county and the school continue to reconcile information. A letter finally goes out to the family in gray in February. The parent has a series of options. You'll see the options listed there about how they handle that. But this is February, and school exclusion dates have been set. And then And then if the child does not have their immunizations completed, or if the parent hasn't made a decision about how they want to seek an exclusion, the child would technically be excluded from school. And that does happen in a select number of cases, and Lorraine can speak to that as a recent example. And then in March and April, we reconcile records. So I think you can appreciate also the complexity that this work involves. And we do very carefully consider when it's appropriate to move a new vaccine into this process, and really what the burden is for the community, as well as really what the importance is in terms of protecting our children and from communicable diseases. So thank you for letting me present this, and we are available with your questions.
I am very impressed with the way this is laid out. So who's responsible? Who's your graphic person?
Chair Morrison, I would like to thank Lorraine Duncan and her program. They've got some tremendously talented people.
Well, I am impressed.
Thank you.
Not only the color, but the way it... color is...
Now fantastic. You know in the future.
I always say our graphic artist, Ann Van Kuren, walks on water.
Okay.
It's just amazing.
Well, not only the color, but the flow charts. And the way the total layout, I think, is extraordinary.
Okay.
Excellent.
She'll be very pleased.
So you will win the award for the year, I think.
Paul said yesterday, gosh, they're colorful.
I can make a tie out of them, right?
Right.
Okay. Lorraine, did you...
Lorraine Duncan, Immunization Program Manager, Oregon Public Health Division. I'd just like to say a couple of words about the annual review and exclusion cycle. So I think most folks know that we're actually in the process. Exclusion orders were mailed on February 4th, and exclusion day is going to be on the 18th. Back in 2006, the advisory committee recommended to the Department of Human Services that we add a couple of new vaccines. So we added Tdap, which is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine for 7th graders, and we added hepatitis A vaccine for our little ones, preschool, Head Start, and certified daycare centers. So the work began then doing the administrative rules and doing a PR campaign to let all the schools and the parents and our doctors know that those are going to be requirements in 2008. So everybody's worked really hard, and the number of exclusion orders, we don't have an exact count, but it's about 35,000 exclusion orders that were mailed out to parents on the 4th of February. That's about double of last year, because when you add new requirements, the number of exclusion orders goes up remarkably. So it's a huge workload for our local health departments and a huge workload for schools and daycare centers to take that on. So that's why the criteria that Catherine mentioned is so critical. We look at really key factors about how we can add that burden to school and daycares with less impact. That most of the public schools have computerized systems, and we approve the algorithms for those computer systems and double check them so that the school staff don't have to memorize all the array of footnotes and complications to the immunization schedules. Daycare centers don't have the IT system, so we've provided overlays for the certificate of immunization status. It's a pretty easy way to evaluate records. But we'd just like to thank all the work from our local health departments. And we have one of our immunization coordinators here today, Kelly Martin from the Marion County Health Department, about the health departments and the schools have worked so hard to enforce the school immunization law.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Doctor?
Chair Morissette, thank you. My name is Dr. Paul Cieslak. I work for the Public Health Division, managing the communicable disease section, and I also serve as medical director for the Oregon Immunization Program. And as Dr. Bradley mentioned, I do serve on the National Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. I'm here for information only. If you have any questions about the processes that are used, the role of the ACIP, the relative role of the state.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think it's important for the committee to know, like when we have the flu vaccine and everyone gets a flu vaccine, but it's the wrong flu, wrong antigen. And the same, I think, with pneumococcal, there's different antigens to pneumococcal also, or is there? And so, you know, we're getting a shot and it isn't really effective, but it's not effective because there's so many different varieties. Can you just address that issue a little bit?
Sure. Chair Morissette, Senator Moniz-Anderson. The influenza vaccine every year is a bit of a crapshoot. They pick three circulating flu strains, two A's and a B, and based on information they get about where influenza, what influenza strains are circulating in the southern hemisphere, which is usually where they are before they come up to us, and they make their best guess, and they hit it right about 80% of the time, and the other times they miss, and there's a strain out there to which the vaccine offers little or no protection. As far as the pneumococcus, there are some 90 strains of pneumococcal disease. When they picked the seven strains that went into the current childhood vaccine, they picked the seven most common ones found in children, and at the time, back around 2000, those amounted to 82% of strains that caused invasive disease in children under 5 years of age. So it was a pretty good shot, and we've seen the disease rates from those strains in children go down to almost nothing, a couple of cases per 100,000 per year, and in fact, in the surveillance system that we have in the Portland Tri-County area, we haven't seen a death from one of those strains from invasive pneumococcal disease since 2001. So the rates are really on the floor for pneumococcal disease at this point. The strains that affect adults are a little bit different, and those same seven strains only accounted for about 50% of disease in adults, and so we wouldn't expect as much a decline in adults if we gave them that strain. That vaccine, I should say.
Yes. Senator Virger.
Yes, one of the most dramatic stories that I've heard recently about immunization, and I'd like to share it with you and then have you respond, and that is that in Africa, where they had almost every woman that was pregnant was carrying the HIV virus. And so the government mandated that they be immunized because they were passing it on to their baby. And they needed to mandate everybody, whether you're carrying the HIV virus or not, you were going to be immunized. But what I heard was that they have now almost this 95% of the babies that do not now carry the HIV virus, and that it's been very, very effective. Are you familiar with that?
Chair Morissette, Senator Virgil, I'm afraid I'm not. I'm not aware of any effective HIV vaccine. It's been a very frustrating endeavor for the researchers.
Okay, maybe you'd like to find out about that, because I think that's quite dramatic, where the percentages of expectant mothers and then the results of the children. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that the mothers don't continue to carry it, but it does mean that there's a new generation that would not be carrying the HIV virus, which I think is a dramatic immunization story, if it's true.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Monahan.
Yeah, I think they're referring to the treatment that they give to women when they are HIV positive. There's treatment to prevent the transfer of HIV to the fetus.
Right.
I think maybe that's what she's referring to.
That's correct.
You
can give antiviral agents to mothers around the time of delivery, and it reduces by about 3/4 the likelihood that mom will pass on the virus to the baby during the birth process or after shortly afterwards.
So that would be different.
That's different
than
from a vaccine.
Than the
that's
immunization. Okay.
Immunization.
Good. I'm glad to have that clarified.
Unfortunately, I guess women in our society can opt out of a blood test for HIV. No, and that to me is absolutely atrociously ridiculous, because HIV that passes through to the unborn child is that should be a criminal offense if there is a way to prevent it. But a woman does have, from what I understand,
he'll clarify it.
Would you clarify that, please?
Chair Morissette, there is a law there is an Oregon statute saying that every pregnant woman must be offered testing for HIV, so that's a requirement, but I do believe that the women can opt out.
Yes. They can opt out of other tests that would harm the fetus, though, right? They
Most of the tests on babies are done after delivery, where a heel stick is gotten and blood is sent to the state public health lab, and they test for a bunch of genetic diseases like phenylketonuria, for example, or hypothyroidism. And that you don't need mom to be tested.
Okay. Well, in order to, from what I, for a marriage license, you have to be tested for syphilis and other communicable diseases. Is that still true?
Actually, I don't know if that's true. I do know that syphilis is another test that is required during pregnancy, or physicians
it is
required to offer it.
To offer it. But they can opt out.
Yes.
Regardless of what it might do to the child.
I believe so, Senator Moore said. Yeah, I don't know that we have any authority to impose therapy on anyone, with the possible exception of, we can do things to people who refuse to be treated for tuberculosis, for example, but that requires a court order, and I don't know that there's any provision for HIV.
Are you aware of other states that do not have the opt-out? Are there states that do not have that opt-out?
I'm just not familiar with other states' laws in this regard.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, back to the subject.
You mean I was deviating from the subject? Okay,
for the very first time. I'm just curious, are there any vaccines that ACIP has recommended that we currently are not doing, and how long does that, because I'm assuming if ACIP hasn't recommended, we aren't doing it, and so at some point in time, their recommendations do become part of our registry or not, or how long does that take?
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, it's an excellent question. The ACIP makes recommendations, but they have nothing to do with mandates. And, in fact, I've discussed this with the staff. They don't even want to be in the business of recommending that states mandate anything for school entry or daycare. So they're completely separate issues. Everything that the ACIP recommends, the state of Oregon also endorses as a matter of routine. However, there are many vaccines that are recommended for universal use in childhood that are not mandated, that we have not taken the step of mandating. Annual influenza vaccination for all children, school-age children, has recently been recommended. We have not mandated that. HPV vaccine for adolescent girls is recommended. We haven't mandated that. Meningococcal vaccine, we have not mandated that either, primarily for reasons of cost-effectiveness. It's an expensive vaccine, and although meningococcal disease is a terrible disease, it's uncommon enough, and when you do the weighing, you can prevent more deaths by using that money elsewhere. And so we haven't mandated that one either. So there are, I think, rotavirus is another one that just came out. It causes diarrhea in children, mostly for cost-effectiveness reasons. We haven't mandated that one either.
Getting back to the original question of SJR 1, do we need to proceed with SJR 1? Okay, the proponent of SJR 1 said that he thought, and he made the statement here that there was some communication that has taken place that would solve the problem, and whether or not we should proceed. Now, I had this hearing because I wanted to give an opportunity for you to, present your case, and I guess we can wait to see if we need to proceed.
Chair Morissette, if I may, this is Catherine Bradley. It's the department's approach that that we've got a process in place, that we've got criteria, that we will have published proceedings that come out of the School Law Advisory Committee that will be available as part of public record, and we're willing to post them on our website, so that we're dealing, I think, with the issue of transparency. In terms of the Ways and Means conversation, we do provide updates in the Ways and Means document about the immunization program activities. Currently, we have not addressed what vaccines are pending. We speak to other directions we've received from Ways and Means about what they want to see in terms of some effectiveness outcomes and issues around the immunization program. But we would be glad to add a paragraph, and we're actually currently finalizing the document, and have that be a permanent part of that document if that would be viewed as being possible.
Okay. Jim, could you come up, please? Give us your... take on what happened today?
Again, Jim Anderson, Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. What I've heard, Mr. Chair, that more than satisfies our needs. To go forward with the bill is up to you. It's in your committee. We, from what I said this morning, what has been said, and the answers given to it, I don't see any reason.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on SJR1, and I'm sorry that we run out of time. We're going to have to go to the floor, and we have not had an opportunity to hear Senate Bill 340. We will carry it over. There was some discussion as to whether or not the proponents of Senate Bill 340 were going to be ready today, and I don't think they were. They have the amendments, and I will check to see if they have them by Monday. But we have a full agenda on Monday.
We have three bills on
Monday. Okay, so what we will do is we will reschedule Senate Bill 340 at the appropriate time, because there's continuing work on that bill, and I don't want to hear it prematurely if you're not ready. So with that, we will adjourn.